Rick read for us the passage that we're going to start out by looking at this morning, Acts chapter 2. Of course, we know it as Pentecost, and when we think of Pentecost, I do not know what's happening. I can hear it. I just don't. It's kind of like Acts chapter 2. They hear this sound, but no. I might turn this one off, see if that helps. I don't know. Can you all still hear me? Okay. Well, we'll see if that helps. I don't know. But we think of these events. We think of this day. Of course, for the Jews, Pentecost was one of their three major festivals. So you have some others that had developed later on, but originally you had, of course, Passover, which had happened 50 days earlier. Then you have Feast of Weeks or Pentecost, the Festival of the First Fruits, where you had the wheat harvest, and that's what we're reading about, some events that happened there today. And then you had Tabernacles that would take place later on during the year. But I kind of want to call your attention. This is only 50 days after Passover, about 50 days after Jesus is put to death. Seven weeks. We're talking about less than 2 months after the crucifixion, which had happened there in Jerusalem in the same city. 7 weeks ago for us was August the 2nd. 50 days ago was August the 1st. So, less than 2 months. And if you think about, a major event happening in Cove 50 days ago, we'd all be pretty aware of it. And this is the timing of in the same way. And the Holy Spirit has come right before the passage that Rick read. The Holy Spirit came, and Peter and the other apostles, they start speaking to the people, but they start speaking, each one in different languages, because you have people from all over the Roman world who had come to Jerusalem, and they start speaking and proclaiming the gospel in different languages, and people are amazed and saying, how do we hear each one in our own language? And yet you have then the Pharisees chime in and say, well, these people are drunk. And that's the response, and that's why in the passage he read, he said, we are not drunk as you suppose. It's only 9 o'clock in the morning. Most people aren't drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning, even if they do, unless they're a real serious alcoholic. That's about the only time you find that. But he quotes from Joel, and he says this is what the prophet Joel spoke about, and he quotes this long passage, 17 through 21, talking about in the last days the pouring out of God's Spirit. And then he gets to verse 22. He says, you that are Israelites, listen to what I have to say. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with deeds of power, wonders, and signs that God did through him among you, as you yourselves know. And so he's calling attention to, they were familiar, some of them, some of the people have maybe came to Jerusalem since then, but many people, even those who came from outside of town, to go to Jerusalem from Rome, in the ancient world was a big deal. You didn't have airplanes and you didn't have automobiles. I know that will come as a surprise to a lot. No, I'm just kidding. But to make a trip from Rome to Jerusalem, those that did come as far away as Rome, this might be a once in a lifetime thing. And so maybe they came down for Passover. It's a long trip. You're either walking or you're going, or you may do part of the trip by boat, but it's a long time to get there. And it's a long trip going home, and so presumably even some of those from far away had come for Passover and were waiting to leave until after the Pentecost festival. But nevertheless, he says, many of you realize, have heard about this Jesus of Nazareth. Some of you witnessed him, that he performed these deeds of power, wonders, and signs among us. And then he goes on and says, verse 23, this man handed over to you according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. Now, I like the NIV translation, but I noticed it said evil men or something like that. I forget the exact word. It didn't say lawless men. Lawless men isn't what we think of. When we think of someone who's lawless, we think of someone who goes down and robs the 7-Eleven or does something bad or evil. Lawless here means those outside the law. It means Gentiles. And the fact of the matter is, if you remember the story, you know, the Jews wanted Jesus put to death, but they were not able to crucify him. So they had to convince Pilate, who was, you know, a Roman, and Roman soldiers to do the dirty work for them. But, you know, you killed by the hands of lawless men. He's not blaming the Romans. He's not excusing them, but he's not blaming the Romans. He says, you Jews, you crucified him by the hands of those outside the law. Because, of course, they had to get those to do this dirty work. So he spent one verse here, verse 22, talking about Jesus' ministry. He spends one verse, verse 23, talking about his death, and he really doesn't go into the death, not even as much as, you know, kind of Tom was talking about this morning, but he does make a quick statement. He was, you know, according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. So he gives us the hint that this death of Jesus was the purpose of God. It was part of God's plan. But he doesn't elaborate on it. He doesn't go into details of what his death means. And then from 24 all the way down through the end of to 36, to the end of the sermon, he's going to talk about the resurrection. And he quotes from a couple different places. He quotes from Psalm 16 about you didn't let your Holy One, you know, reap corruption and, you know, die and that sort of thing. And then he quotes from Psalm 110 about, you know, that the Lord said to my Lord and things like that. And things like that. But he quotes, and then he will make this statement in and I'm losing my place, and this is what happens when I don't stick closely to my notes. But verse 32, this Jesus God raised up, and of that we, all of us, are witnesses. And then he goes on talking more about the resurrection, and you get to verse 36. Therefore, let the entire house of Israel know with certainty that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. And again, as he's going through here, he's talking about this, and he's saying, you witnessed his miracles, you witnessed his signs and wonders, you know how he was put to death. Many of them, you know, were there, maybe there when Jesus entered Jerusalem. They were there when Jesus was teaching in the temple. They had witnessed these events. And then they're coming along and they're telling people, but God rose him up from the dead, and God has declared him to be both Lord and Christ. And he says, you are the ones that crucified him. And I don't think that means that every single one of them were involved in his crucifixion. I think it's more that some of the people may have been, or part of the Jewish leadership, but some of them may have been. Some of this large crowd may have been the ones yelling, crucify him. But it happened, the bigger point, it happened right, these events happened right there in the city 50 days earlier. But again, he goes on and he elaborates and he says, but God raised him from the dead. And he quotes from Psalm 16, he quotes from Psalm 110. He says, of these events, we are witnesses, and God has declared him to be Lord in Christ. And before I go on this, I want to back up a little bit to the end of chapter 1, or I guess the middle of chapter 1, after the ascension. When they come back to Jerusalem, he says in verse 13, you know, it says, when they arrived, they went upstairs to the room where they were staying. Those present were Peter, John, James, and Andrew, Philip, Thomas, Bartholomew, Matthew, James the son of Alphaeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas the son of James. They all joined together constantly in prayer, along with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers, that is Jesus' brothers, which two of them are James and Jude, who wrote two of the books, two of the letters we have in the New Testament. And in those days, Peter stood up among the believers, a group numbering about 120. And he goes on, and I'm not going to read this part, but he talks about the death of Judas. And so you have the 11 here, and they want a 12th again. 12 is a significant number. There's 12 tribes of Israel. If they're establishing this new kingdom, they want 12. But anyway, so you have the 11, you have the mother of Jesus, you have James and Jude, the half-brothers of Jesus, and it says about 120 at all. And then he says in verse 21, therefore it's necessary to choose one of the men who have been with us the whole time that Jesus was living among us, beginning with John's baptism up until the day he was taken from us. And then listen to this at the end of verse 22. For one of these must become a witness with us of his resurrection. So they want someone who dates, you know, was a follower of Jesus, a disciple of Jesus, going back to his baptism by John all the way up until the ascension. I doubt they witnessed every single event of Jesus' life, but someone who had heard his teaching, who had seen some of his miracles, but most importantly, someone who had risen, had witnessed Jesus resurrected from the dead, because this person, along with the other 11, is going to become a witness of Jesus' resurrection. So I want to stop and think for just a minute. I think Jesus' teachings were important. You know, he taught us to love our enemies, to pray for those who persecute us, just a lot of really good teaching. Jesus also made some pretty tremendous claims. He claimed to forgive sins. He claimed to be the Messiah. He claimed to be God's Son, and not in a way you and me talk about when we talk about being children of God, but literally the Son of God. But you know, anybody can make tremendous claims. There is a man a number of years ago, not too far away from here, and you know, we may think they're crazy, but you know, there was a man named David Koresh, the Branch Davidians over in Waco, and he claimed to be some sort of Messiah. Now, not everyone can perform signs and wonders, which they mention here, but people can make bold claims. But if Jesus was raised from the dead, then all of a sudden it ratchets up a whole, everything he said and everything he said about himself, it ratchets that up a whole lot of notches. All that he says becomes very important. And if he claimed to be God's Son, it may sound far-fetched, but if he came back to life, all of a sudden it's not very far-fetched anymore. So I think when you get to the end of that sermon in Acts chapter 2, and it says, that God made him to be both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified, Jesus was already Lord and Christ. But when he says God made him Lord and Christ, he declared him to be. He showed him to be in a powerful way that this is Lord and Messiah. And the evidence of that is God raised him up from the dead. And Peter is proclaiming, and we are all witnesses. I know I mentioned a number of times the writer and scholar by the name of N.T. Wright. He wrote a little book in the early 90s entitled, Who Was Jesus? This is my favorite quote of his. He's not talking specifically about the resurrection, but he is talking about the resurrection and Jesus' claims, but more than the resurrection. But he's responding to three books that had just come out not long ago. one by a woman named Barbara Thering, another by a man named A.N. Wilson, and another by John Spong, liberal scholars who wrote books about Jesus. And he's responding to their ideas, and he makes a claim in his book, Who Was Jesus?, that Jesus is the Christ, that he is the one who fulfills the hopes of Israel, and that God was really at work in his life. And he gets to the very last paragraph of his book, and he says this, "And what we may ask is so difficult about accepting for oneself that this claim of Jesus might be true." He says, "Hey, there's the rub. To do this would cost no less than everything. But perhaps that's what we should expect. Pearls of a great price do not come cheap." And I don't know if you understand everything he's saying there, but what it pointed out to me as he's dealing in dealing with these liberal scholars and things like that, he's making the point that if liberal scholars accept Jesus as God's son, you can't be neutral at that point. If you accept him as God's son, the next thing you've got to do is take up your cross and follow him. I mean, if his claims are true, it makes a demand on your life. And he says that's where the rub is. It's not that there's not good historical testimony. It's that you can't, if you accept the resurrection is true and these other things is true, it makes demands on your life, and they would have to change their life. This is absolutely true of the resurrection. Is there good historical testimony of the resurrection? I think so. But I think there's two reasons why most historians don't accept the resurrection. And I'm talking about historians that believe in the basic life of Jesus, believe he was born sometime between 4 and 6 BC, believe he died somewhere in the late 20s, believe he was crucified on the cross under Pilate. They believe the basic story of Jesus' life. But there's two reasons they don't accept the resurrection. One, and I've said this before, is because it's a miracle. And if you start out with the idea that miracles are impossible, then no amount of evidence will satisfy you if you read about a miracle. And on one hand I see it, but on the other hand I don't. If there's something that you see in your life that the only explanation for is that it's a miracle, I think maybe you should reevaluate your philosophy. If something's obviously a miracle, then maybe you should think miracles maybe are possible. But the second big reason that I think people reject the resurrection, that why there are so many and so many historians that are going to dismiss the resurrection, is you cannot say, "I believe that Jesus was raised, but I don't want to make him Lord of my life." I mean, you can say that, but it doesn't make any sense. If you're not open to accepting him as Lord, then you cannot accept the historical testimony of the resurrection, no matter how good that historical testimony is. The moment you admit the resurrection is the same moment you pretty much have to bow down like Thomas and say, "My Lord and my God." It's not like you can be an unbeliever and say, "I really think, that there's good evidence and the resurrection happened," and then say, "Well, what time do the Texans play this afternoon?" I mean, you can't go on your life as normal if you accept the resurrection. And I think it was the resurrection more than any other event that verified that Jesus really was Lord and Messiah. And Peter and the others, for that reason, are out there testifying to and telling people about the resurrection. And again, we're talking 50 days. We're talking less than 2 months after his crucifixion. If opponents can't find his grave, and more importantly, if they can't find his body that was buried a few weeks earlier, I mean, if they could, I guess I should say it the other way around. If they could find his grave, and more importantly, if they could find his body that was buried a few weeks earlier, Christianity would be in shambles. But if there is no body, if there is an empty tomb, and if he is really risen from the dead, then God has in a powerful way demonstrated him to be Lord and Messiah. I mean, think again about it. You know, you take the virgin birth. It's a great miracle. But what other explanation could you give for the virgin birth? Now, and you don't have to think about this. I'll tell you. It's really the reaction of Joseph when he finds out his fiancée Mary is pregnant. What is he getting ready to do immediately? He plans to divorce her quietly. He understands how a person gets pregnant, and if he didn't get her pregnant, he has an idea what it's about. Of course, an angel comes to him and says, "Do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife." But young women have gotten pregnant for thousands of years. The only ones who knew for sure that it was miraculous are Mary, the mother of Jesus, and Joseph, because the angel came and appeared to him. But Mary knew that something miraculous had happened, but other people could have their suspicions. You know, and when I think about the resurrection, I try to put on the shoes of someone who is not a Christian. At the same time, I look at it with what I know now of early Christian history and the early testimony that we have. I think we've got pretty reliable history that Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate. I mentioned before that there was this famous, the Pilate stone was discovered in 1961, and for a long time before that, scholars had questioned whether there even was a Pontius Pilate. So you had a lot of liberal scholars saying this Pontius Pilate was a made-up figure and things like that, until the Pilate stone was discovered, and now everybody accepts that he was prefect there in Israel from 26, down in Judea from 26 to 36 A.D., and we know that Herod the Great died in 4 BC, and he was still alive when Jesus was born. So most people think somewhere Jesus born sometime between about 4 and 6 BC, shortly before Herod dies. His death had to be sometime after 26 AD during the reign of Pontius Pilate. And more than this, you know, I think there's more than that. I've come to the conclusion that Luke is a good historian. You know, there's some who have basically claimed, you know, these are just made-up stories. There was a man in the late 1900s, an author by the name of William Ramsey, who wrote a book called wrote a book called St. Paul, the Traveler and the Roman Citizen, and he came from a liberal background. But when Ramsey first went to Asia Minor, what we know now as Turkey, he went there when many of the cities mentioned in the book of Acts had no definite location. You know, people thought maybe some of these places were just made up. We didn't really know about a lot about first century Asia Minor. But later in life, he concluded, he said, "Further study showed that the book could bear the most minute scrutiny as an authority of the facts of the Aegean world, and that it was written with such judgment, skill, art, and perception of truth as to be a model of historical statement." But one of the things he did is he tried to retravel the missionary journeys of Paul. And he discovered all these cities were exactly where the book of Acts said that they were and things like that. And he says in the same book later, he said, "You may press the words of Luke to a degree beyond any other historians." Now, that might be a little bit of overstatement, but I don't think much. I'm going to mention just a little bit later in the sermon, and this is what brought this to my mind, but I had to move some stuff around. But I'm going to mention the death of James, the son of Zebedee, a little bit later. But I know it's in that same chapter in Luke chapter 12. It talks about the death of Herod Antipas the First. And what's interesting about that, I got thinking back on that, what's interesting to me about the death of Herod Antipas I is it fits perfectly with the same Herod Antipas I, the death described in Josephus' works. It fits perfectly with that. Another passage I think of is Acts chapter 17. Luke will mention that Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. Well, there's a work that comes out later in the first century, well after Luke, called the 12 Caesars, which he mentions in an obscure passage, that at the instigation of Crestus, which is probably a reference to Christ, that Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. But there's lots of little things like that, that through the years have led credibility to me of Luke's history. The way the timeline in Acts fits with Galatians and 1 Corinthians and Romans, and I'm not going into all the details because you don't want me to. I'm taking too long as it is. But one time I was talking to two of my friends at A&M, and they were smart guys, which some of you might think is an oxymoron, but they were smart guys. They were from Cove. I graduated 10th in my class. Not that anybody cares what you graduated in your class years ago, but they both graduated ahead of me. They graduated higher than me. But I was a freshman in college, and it's when I was starting to have some doubts and things like that. And one of them said, "What if this whole thing, you know, what if the whole New Testament was just made up?" And at the time when I was having some doubts, you know, it sounded good. Well, maybe what if the whole thing was made up? But I couldn't believe that now. If so, it had to be a very elaborate hoax. Because you have many different authors with many different writing styles, and I do know some Greek, and I have translated some Greek, and they're different writing styles, it's obvious. Written over a number of different decades. And like I say, I really get the impression that Luke did his research. And I'm going to use an analogy, but there's an expression, death by a thousand cuts. And I don't know if you all have heard that before, but, you know, it's kind of like paper cuts or something like that, you know. But it could be used, you know, it could be said of a project. If you have a project and this project ends up getting scrapped, not because there's one major flaw with the project, but there's just one minor setback after another. You know, this problem comes up, then this other little problem comes up, and, you know, problem after problem after problem. None of them in of themselves a big deal, but it just seems like one thing after another that finally it's like it's not worth it anymore. The project gets scrapped. And I only say that because my experience with Acts is just the opposite. It's not one major thing that convinces me that Luke is a good historian, but there's lots of little things here and there that convince me that Luke is a good historian and that this is rooted in history, like Claudius' edict that I mentioned a moment ago, like the death of Herod Antipas I, which fits with other historical records of that day. A lot of the things that William Ramsey will point out in his book, like when he talks about going up to this city or coming down to this city and things like that, he says it's not as we think of today, it's not north and south, but it's elevation. And when he says they went up, if you walk along that path, they went up in elevation, and where it talks about them going down, it's good they're going down to a place of lower elevation and things like that. The way it fits with Paul's letters, and not only the way it fits with Paul's letters, but the way at first it doesn't seem to fit, and then you look at it a little closer, and it really does fit. And I don't really know how to explain it. You know, there's some people who go to seminary and they lose their faith. You know, they come across some difficulties with certain things in the Old Testament, and it raises questions, and sometimes they don't have easy answers to those questions. But my experience was really the opposite. You know, getting to go to seminary and things like that, I'm convinced that there was a Paul, and that there was a Luke, and there was a Peter, and there was a Jesus, and that these are real historical figures. And my faith has actually increased because I realize that this is rooted in history. And then we have these famous we sections in the book of Acts where Paul arrives in Jerusalem. And you know who's traveling with him in those we sections is Luke. Luke is traveling with him. And of course, Paul gets arrested and he's there in Jerusalem and then Caesarea. And he ends up there in Israel for 2 years in prison. And Luke, we know from the book of Acts, Luke is there when Paul leaves to go to Rome. So Luke arrives with Paul in Israel and then he leaves. And so Luke is stuck there for Israel in 2 years. And that 2 years that he's stuck in Israel gives him a chance to talk to some of the primary sources, to James, the half-brother of the Lord, to Peter and the other apostles, to other people, other early witnesses, other people that were there from the very foundings of the church. And according to Luke and according to earliest Christian tradition, that they were out there proclaiming the resurrection 50 days, only 7 weeks, less than 2 months after Jesus' crucifixion, they were already proclaiming the resurrection of Jesus in Jerusalem, the same city he died less than 2 months earlier. People there were familiar with his death. It's the same city he was buried, and they're out there publicly proclaiming the resurrection. You know, if Jesus died and that was the end, it's pretty easy to dismiss him. But if he rose from the dead, it's almost impossible to dismiss him. Now, there's been various theories proposed to try to explain away the resurrection. One is called the swoon theory. It says that basically it's the idea Jesus did not really die. He just passed out. He appeared to be dead. He was taken to be buried. And sometimes they think they even buried him, put him in the tomb. But then he comes to, he wakes up, and it doesn't explain where he is. It still doesn't explain where he is 50 days later, even if you believe in this so-called swoon theory. The other idea some people have come up with is there was this mass hallucination that you had the 12 and his mother and his brothers were so close to Jesus and mourning him so much, they missed him so much, which we can understand. I mean, it's if you've lost a loved one, you do. But they think there's this mass hallucination where they all think that Jesus appeared to them. And the only thing I'm going to say about these things is they sound way far more fetched to me than the resurrection itself. I see only three realistic alternatives, and really two, but I'm going to mention three just because it's probably out there. One is the idea that the whole thing's a legend. And again, I don't buy it's a legend. Luke, who writes Acts, he spends 2 years down there in Israel, presumably talks to primary sources, probably talked with Peter. When they get to Jerusalem, he says there were thousands of Christians living in Jerusalem that were zealous for the law. There's little doubt, I think, on historical basis that the church began in Jerusalem. It's not until Acts 8 until it moves to Samaria. It's not until Acts 10 that you have the first Gentile convert. But looking at things from a historical standpoint, I don't think it's a legend that developed 5 or 10 years or 20 years down the road. I think it's a much more likely scenario that the early Christian tradition is true and that they're out there proclaiming the resurrection from day one. And by day one, I really mean day 50. I really mean Pentecost when, you know, but almost immediately they're out there proclaiming the resurrection. So I think there's two real alternatives. One is they were lying, or two, Jesus rose from the dead. And the first option that they were lying is actually mentioned in Acts 28. It says a theory of the Jews. It says, you know, after the resurrection, when the soldiers, it says, verse 12, when the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep." So the soldiers report to the chief priest about Jesus being raised, and they tell him, you tell people that his disciples came during the night and stole him away while you were asleep. So the soldiers, verse 15, so the soldiers took the money, and they did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. And this very day is obviously talking about the time Matthew's gospel is written, that a popular story among the Jews is his disciples came and stole the body. So one alternative is the disciples, the apostles, as we know them as, were lying. I don't think it is a lie. Maybe sometimes people overstate this fact, you know, kind of point out, you know, kind of say that all of them died for what they believed and things like that. And we don't know what happened to all his apostles. But we know that they stick to this message even when it leads to persecution. Acts chapter 12, as I mentioned earlier, records the death of James, the son of Zebedee, also known as James the Great, one of the inner three. You have pretty good historical testimony, I believe, that Peter and Paul died in Rome during the persecutions under Nero. I don't know that Peter died upside down. That's a later tradition that comes from later. I know that's popular and said a lot. I don't know that he died upside down. I do believe he died because he was a Christian, and I believe he died in Rome. James, the half-brother of the Lord, dies in Jerusalem. Obviously, after Paul's visit there, before he heads to Rome, but sometime in the early to mid-60s, we have, I think, some evidence that James, the half-brother of the Lord, does die in Jerusalem. And absolutely, I think you had some of the early leaders and apostles that were willing to die for what they are preaching and what they were convinced they had seen. And you know, you only have to turn over the page to Acts 3 and Acts 4 to start seeing some persecution come up, you know, some threats. You stop preaching this. You stop telling this message. But I guess my question is, does this lend credibility to their testimony? And I think it does. Would many of you be willing to die for what you knew was a lie? Not only that, but their lives are absolutely changed by what they claim to have seen. You see Peter speaking out there boldly. You see it also in the life of Paul. And I know Paul is one, he refers to himself as an apostle untimely born. He saw the resurrected Lord not during these days before Pentecost, but he saw him on the Damascus Road. You know, if Paul was doing his preaching of Christianity in the Greco-Roman world for prosperity and happiness, he chose the wrong occupation. Maybe in the 21st century, it's a good occupation. You have people like Joel Osteen and things making a pretty good money off of it. But Paul was shipwrecked. He was beaten with lashes, faced hardships galore. I know he wasn't one of the original 12, but he had, like I said, his own experience on Damascus. But he suffered immensely going out and proclaiming this gospel. And he himself had a chance to talk with some of the primary witnesses, with Peter and the other apostles. But I mean, it doesn't make any sense. He's doing what he's doing unless he is absolutely convinced that Jesus had risen from the dead. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that early Christianity was founded on the miracle of the resurrection. Christianity is not just a set of teachings, and it is. There's a lot of teachings here, a lot of good doctrine. But it was based, early Christianity was really founded on the claim that Jesus rose from the dead. And you don't find anything like that in Islam. You don't find anything like that in Buddhism. You have the 12 and others 7 weeks after his crucifixion claiming that he was raised from the dead and had been taken to be with God. And they are willing to be persecuted for it. They are willing to die for it. Obviously, we are living 2,000 years later. And we don't have the opportunity to talk to Peter and James and John and James, the half-brother of Jesus, and Jude and things like that. And it's a little bit harder since we're further removed. But it doesn't change the fact that we have good historical testimony of the resurrection. That very early on, Christians were proclaiming the resurrection, and as far as we know, none of the original apostles ever backed down or backtracked from it. Obviously, Judas had betrayed Jesus before his resurrection. But Matthias and the other 11, none of them backed down. I think we actually have pretty good reason to believe that the resurrection was true. I absolutely know that there are other factors involved in conversion. You know, is a person's heart right? Does a person desire to do the will of God? There are a lot of other reasons why a person might or might not accept the Christian claims as true. But my appeal to anyone that might not be a Christian is examine these claims for yourselves. If you have an open heart and an open mind, if you're interested in the truth, then examine these claims about Jesus for yourself. I believe that Jesus rose from the dead, and because of that, I believe that he is Lord and he is the Christ. If there's anyone here that's never turned to Jesus and wants to today, we invite you to come while together we stand and we sing.